Lecture 16, Heidegger on the World and the Self.
Being in time is the study of Dasein and its essential structures. In simpler language, we can say being in time is basically a concern about ourselves in the world and how we fit into the world. There are two features I want to talk about, two existential structures, if you like, in this lecture. The first is the nature of knowledge, which of course has been the focus of philosophers since at least the Greeks. The second is the notion of the self, which in the terms that we're going to be speaking essentially has been the main concern of philosophy since at least Descartes. What concerns me is the way that Heidegger wants to examine, and again I will make the apology, the basic structures of experience, a term which again he would reject. And what he wants to say is that if we look at the basic structures of experience, or what he would call our primordial take on the world, what we find, as we saw in the last lecture, is that we don't find ourselves as a consciousness, as a thinking thing, but rather we find ourselves as being in the world, in which world and ourselves, Dasein, are utterly inseparable. But to even talk about knowledge is to enter into a domain which philosophers, according to Heidegger, have not understood at all. Philosophers, from their armchair stance, or what one of Heidegger's very good contemporaries, the American philosopher John Dewey, called the spectator view of the world. Essentially, what philosophers tend to think of is the world as something to be known. And thinking about the world as something to be known, one thinks in terms of, for example, the categories of knowledge, the question of what it is for something to be a thing, the question of what it is for things to be in causal relations, and so on. But for Heidegger, all of this is very late in the game. And to think of this as our primordial experience of the world is to miss something very basic. Instead, what Heidegger wants to say is, we are not, first of all, knowers. We are not, first of all, spectators. But rather, our first of all experience of the world is as engagement. What does engagement mean? Well, it means that what we're involved in are tasks, things to be done. What we're involved in is a world with other people in which we know we must obey them, we have to get along with them, we have to cope with them. And in most of this, to talk about knowledge in a way is beside the point. In fact, Heidegger wants to make it into a kind of puzzle. How it is that we come to have anything like the knowledge that philosophers talk about? What are the conditions that make that knowledge possible? What are the conditions of our talking about ourselves? What are the conditions of talking about things? In a philosopher like Kant, the idea that the world consists of objects, or someone like Wittgenstein, where the world is everything that is the case, states of affairs, and so on, we might think what they're talking about is something that, on the one hand, is obvious. But what Heidegger wants to say is it's not obvious at all. In fact, it's a mystery how we can talk in such language at all. What does it mean to be engaged? Well, the first thing to say is that to be engaged is to care. And in Heidegger's philosophy, in Being in Time, caring takes the place of all those more cognitive notions that appear in most philosophers, in particular, the notion of knowledge. We live in the world because we care about things. We act because we care. Now, caring is a concept that has a long history. One should be very careful not to confuse caring with, for example, caring for others or caring about others. Heidegger himself was not a particularly caring person. Nor should we think of caring in the sense of anxiety and worry, although one should remember that the use of that word, sorge, was also a major piece of Goethe's famous play Faust, in which sorge quite explicitly refers to the burdens of worry and the world. But caring in Heidegger means something just much more general. It has to do with being involved, being concerned, having ends, having purposes. He therefore talks about the world not in terms of things, and not things that we know, but rather he talks about the world in terms of what he calls equipment. Now you might say that it is a matter of knowledge, but it's knowing how rather than knowing that. It's not observing or being a spectator, but it's rather being engaged in tasks. Let's take a very Heideggerian example. I walk into my workshop, and there are a couple of planks that need to be nailed together. I reach up and I pick up the hammer, and I take the nails, and I hammer. If I describe the phenomenology of that experience, what I will describe is not a hammer and nails and planks and my behavior in hammering the nails into the planks. Rather, it's, as Heidegger puts it, all of a piece. There's a kind of totality of equipment, the workshop as a whole. And what I focus on is simply the task to be done. The hammer is not a hammer. It's something I use for a purpose. The nail is not a nail, but something I use for a purpose. And the plank is not a plank, but rather it's the material that I'm working with. Again, one might talk well here about knowing how to do something. But notice, in this description, to think about the items which I'm using in the tool shop for this task as things is a kind of misdescription. What is it to see the hammer as a thing? Well, to see it as a thing means that I stop hammering, first of all. I hold it up and I look at it. And then it becomes a piece of wood with a slab of metal on the top. I can now analyze it into its components, and perhaps I can explain why it is so useful in terms of hammering nails into planks. But what I've done is now a very special piece of behavior. It's not part of my engagement in tasks, but it's looking at the hammer as something separate, something distinct. And that's precisely what we don't find in my treatment of the world as equipment, in my involvement in tasks. You watch children at play or doing routine tasks, and there's a sense in which they don't see anything as a thing. What they are doing is they are completely involved, completely engaged in their activities. And of course, just as Heidegger wants to say that all of the items in the equipment are a totality and they function together, he also wants to say that I, as the actor, am nothing but part of that same totality. To think of myself as something separate, as an agent who is doing this task, is again too much of a stretch, and it is something that enters into our vocabulary only as a very special step. So, one way to ask the question is, under what circumstances do we stop simply involving ourselves in tasks and pursuing purposes, and instead start seeing the things that we use as things? And that means as not part of the totality of equipment, but as individual instruments or individual items. Well, think about the hammer example. When I'm hammering, there is a point at which I will very likely hold the hammer out and take a look at it. For example, if the head flies off so I can no longer hammer, I will look at it and I'll say, what's wrong with this picture? And at that point I'll notice that the hammer doesn't have a head. Or if you're taking notes and your pen runs out of ink, suddenly you'll look at your pen and you realize it's a pen and it's malfunctioning. But when I watch people write and when I write myself, I know I reach into my pocket, I pull out a pen, I start writing. I never look at the pen. I don't think, where's the pen? Unless, of course, I can't find it, which is a different kind of breakdown. But basically, the pen is simply part of the equipment that I'm using to perform certain kinds of tasks. One of the ironies here is that paying attention, making something into a thing, can actually interfere with the task at hand. An obvious kind of example. If you ask somebody who is typing, where are the different keys? How do you know what's what? How do you figure out which finger to use on which key? And I'm assuming someone has been typing for years and does it by touch. Well, the truth is, they will find themselves at that moment incapable of typing, because what is normally a completely involved activity in which one doesn't stop to think what one is doing, suddenly we are asked to focus on our fingers and the typewriter as a thing, and then suddenly we are incapable of behaving. Or different kind of example, there's a childhood poem I remember about the centipede who was asked, how do you manage to coordinate all those different legs? And the centipede at that point becomes essentially paralyzed because he can't figure it out. Whereas, of course, before the question was asked, he was perfectly happy just walking along. One can think here about a point I made about Camus and the kind of antithesis between, on the one hand, lived experience, but now let's talk about engagement, and on the other hand, reflection. The one can actually interfere with the other, but to think that reflection is the basis of human consciousness and human life is to get it all wrong. What we'll see in Sartre as well is pre-reflection is more important. What we do, in a way, unconsciously, that is, without stopping to look and think and take in these things as things. A different kind of example. In Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about Sherlock Holmes and his friend Dr. Watson, there is one question that Holmes is rather fond of asking of Watson by way of embarrassing him, and that is, how many steps do you take up to my flat? A walk which Dr. Watson has made hundreds or thousands of times. And Watson is terribly flustered and embarrassed to realize he doesn't know. And of course, Holmes then criticizes him for his powers of deduction. Actually, one would say induction, but that's a different matter. But the idea is that Holmes has seen things, noticed things that Watson has not, even though, in fact, he has done the same stair climbing that Holmes has done for all those years. Well, I want to side with Watson on this one, even though Watson doesn't try to defend himself. And it seems to me what Holmes is saying is something which is, if not wrong, it's slightly neurotic. I walk up to the steps of my office every day, and I have for 20 years, and I haven't a clue how many steps there are. I don't count. Now, there are people who are just natural counters, but the truth is that when we walk up steps, when we do tasks, when we do all sorts of things in which we are engaged, we don't notice, in an important sense, what it is we're doing. We don't have that kind of consciousness which spells itself out as knowledge of things or knowledge that such and such is the case. Rather, what we're concerned with is getting the task done. Now, this spells itself out in a large number of ways in Heidegger's philosophy. But one of the more fascinating ones, which I'm just going to jump to a bit out of sequence, is the idea that this way of thinking about the world in terms of an active engagement is something which, in his kind of celebration of peasant life, is very much, in a way, the paradigm of his philosophy. When he thinks about peasantry, and later in his career he will actually say things like, peasants really have the answer to the question of being in a way that philosophers since Plato do not. Because peasants are actively engaged in their world. They don't stop to think much about it. They don't necessarily label things. And consequently, there's a kind of ideal of pre-reflective engagement that Heidegger entertains. This is to be contrasted with something which may easily be confused with it, namely the sense of using the world as a kind of resource. And I mention this because one of the main targets of Heidegger's later philosophy, certainly, is the whole philosophy of technology. And the alienation I mentioned at the end of the last lecture comes about in the modern world, according to Heidegger, more because of technology than anything else. It is a way of thinking about the world not in terms of our place in it and our activities in it so much as it is thinking of the world as something alien, as something which is merely a resource. And consequently, even apart from the ecological issues, it is a way of seeing the world which loses the charm and loses the immediacy that our simply behaving in the world tends to capture. Technology also makes everything the same. And of course, this is a very old criticism going back at least to Marx, whom of course Heidegger would have despised, but the idea that money reduces everything to the same level. And consumerism in the 20th century is something that Heidegger again despised. But it's interesting and important to see just why. Because what these things do is quite the contrary of simply going back to the idea of being engaged in the world. What they do is they separate us from it, and they separate us from each other. The whole notion of competition, the whole notion of consumerism, basically makes us, in a sense, greatly inferior and diminished beings. And Heidegger's original flirtation with the Nazi Party had to do with the Nazi promise to capture, in a sense, the old rural Germany, even though, as he said, the Nazis very quickly turned to the same kind of technological obsessions that the Russians and the Americans displayed. But what I want to conclude this part with is to say what Heidegger is concerned with here is not just a narrow set of philosophical issues about what counts as knowledge, what counts as experience, how we should understand ourselves in a phenomenological way. He has much bigger fish on the line. And what he's ultimately interested in is a question about what it is to be a human being, even if that's a term that he doesn't use. Which brings us back to the question about what the self is. Again, the starting point, I think, must be Descartes' notion. I think, therefore, I am, and consequently, I'm a thinking thing. We've already seen that this leads to a split between mind and body, something that Heidegger is obviously going to reject immediately, because it's not as if I have a mind distinct from my body. And when I'm engaged in the world in tasks, obviously what I'm doing is I am using my body, not as, to use a Cartesian metaphor, as a kind of captain running a ship, but rather I am using my body and it is me as my body that is engaged in the activity. One might notice also that there's a sense in Descartes with this I think, therefore I am, that self-knowledge is immediate. And one might add it is also unmistakable. Descartes uses this as a proof that here is at least one proposition which is absolutely self-evident and undoubtable. Truth is, according to Heidegger, that we don't know what ourselves are. And anything remotely resembling true self-recognition, in fact, is a rare thing. Which leads us to perhaps the most famous single concept in Heidegger's philosophy, and that's the concept of authenticity. This will be the subject of the next lecture, so I'm just going to mention it here. But let me say that authenticity, first of all, doesn't mean, as it does in English, simply genuine. But it also means something which is quite obvious in the German word itself, eigentlich, something having to do with being one's own. And so to be authentic, be an authentic self, to be a true human being, if I can use that language, is to be one's own person. By contrast, there is also inauthenticity. And inauthenticity is not being one's own self, not, in a sense, being a true person. Again, Heidegger introduces a coinage. The coinage is what he calls das Mann. Again, it's a word which is derived from perfectly ordinary German. Mann, with one N, is the word that is used in such phrases as there is, or one is. So we say, for example, one doesn't do that sort of thing around here. And what's interesting about that kind of expression is it doesn't refer to anyone in particular. It doesn't refer to the authorities. It doesn't refer to the law. It doesn't refer to the person who's speaking or any particular group that they represent. One doesn't do these things around here is, in a way, a reference to the anonymity of the group. And this is what Heidegger wants to say is the way most of us, in fact, think of ourselves. So he talks about the Das Mann self, where the Das Mann self is an anonymous self. It's not an individual self. It is not particularly a reflective self, not the self of Cartesian reflection anyway. It is inauthentic through and through. But let me say something about why that's the case. The first thing to notice is that when we talk about ourselves, we almost always talk about ourselves in terms of our place in a group, our roles. So in American society, the question, what do you do, is really the question, who are you? And the answer usually has to do with your job, or your position in your company, or the fact that you're a student, or the fact that you are a student studying classics, or whatever. We give our identity in terms of our social roles. But now, in an important sense, our social roles aren't us. If you type up a brief biography, a resume, perhaps applying for a job, and you write down where you went to high school and what awards you won, and then where you went to college and what you've done there, and perhaps some of your extracurricular activities, what you're listing essentially are your social roles and your social rankings. And I think there are a few of us who haven't done such a task and then pulled it out of the typewriter or the computer, looked at it and said, wait a minute, that's not really me. That's just some of my accomplishments, some of the things I've done. The truth is, when we describe ourselves, what we inevitably describe are precisely the roles that we play. And as I say, our status, comparative to other people. So when I say of myself, for example, that I'm intelligent, I'm implicitly comparing myself with others, perhaps on the basis of one of those tests like an IQ test, perhaps on the basis of my ability to perform well in school. But in any case, intelligence is not actually something that I myself have, but rather it's a way of comparing myself with other people. If I say of someone that they're good-looking, or if I say of someone that they are charming, these are obviously social categories. It has to do with not only the values of a particular culture or subculture, it has to do with relations and comparisons between people. In short, when we talk about ourselves, we tend to talk about ourselves in terms of roles or positions or statuses, which someone else might occupy instead of us. If I were not a student at the University of Texas, say, then that slot would be filled by someone else. And none of my teachers would miss me because they wouldn't know that I existed or didn't exist. The same argument could be made in a more extreme way. If you hadn't been born, someone else might have been born in your place. And we can play with this as science fiction and say they might have even looked exactly like you and been raised exactly as you. That doesn't matter. What's important is they're not you. And the question is, what is missing from the world? Well, your parents wouldn't notice anything because they have the child they have in your place. And none of their friends or your current friends would notice because there's someone else that they have to play with. There's a sense in which nothing is missing except you. What is that you? And that's where the question of authenticity is going to come in. But the Das Man self is nothing but this social comparative self. It is not the real self, but nevertheless, Heidegger is going to say, it is an essential part of life, because when in our pre-reflective engagement in tasks, we often tend to be engaged with other people. And that sense of being engaged with other people is going to be precisely the idea that we are part of a group in which we fit ourselves in terms of being part of the group. Or to take a different kind of example, if I go to a football game and I'm there cheering with thousands of other people, I am generally not aware of myself as an individual, as a self, but rather I am aware of myself only as part of the cheering crowd. So the idea of Das Man here is to give us a picture of the self, which most of us take to be our genuine selves, which Heidegger wants to say is really not that at all. There's a sense in which one can detect here a return to two of Heidegger's greatest influences, and those are the two philosophers, Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. He read both of them carefully. He was actually rather fond of both, Kierkegaard because of his religious sensibilities, Nietzsche in a much more general way that has to do with volumes of Nietzsche misinterpretation, which I don't want to get into here. But nevertheless, Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, one thing they had in common was a rejection of what they referred to as herd mentality. And Nietzsche in particular rejected with some vigorousness, the whole idea of being part of the herd. The idea is that one has to be an individual. In Kierkegaard, one is not a Christian because one lives in a Christian community. One is not a Christian because one is surrounded by Christians. One is not a Christian because other people think you're a Christian. You are a Christian all by yourself. It is a personal relationship with God. And it is a mere matter of happenstance that there are other Christians in the world with you. It is an extremely individualistic philosophy, as we saw. And in Nietzsche, while the notion of the individual there tends to become more ambiguous, nevertheless, Nietzsche's reaction against herd mentality and what he calls slave morality, which is, again, the whole idea of fitting in with a crowd, finding safety in the crowd, the idea of exercising values which are protective of the crowd, is something diametrically opposed to what he obviously prefers in terms of master morality or his image of the Übermensch, the idea that to be a real person is to be, in a very important and powerful sense, independent, and in particular, independent of other people's opinions and influence. This strong emphasis on individuality, as I've said, is going to permeate all of the existentialist figures we're talking about. But in Heidegger's language, it has to do with taking hold of yourself. But let's not leave it there. That notion might very well be Kierkegaardian or Nietzschean or, as we'll see, Sartrean. But the idea of being authentic and taking hold of yourself, in a way, lifting yourself by your own bootstraps, is at most half the picture in Heidegger. And even there, I would say, subject to many qualifications, which I'll try in the next lecture. He also has a notion that we are thrown into the world. It's a very dramatic notion. It's an idea which has, I think, real charm because we've all imagined, for example, what it would be like if we lived in the, say, 13th century or the 19th century, or what it would have been like if we had been born 10 years earlier or perhaps 10 years later. And when we imagine that, we realize the contingency of our existence, the fact that we didn't choose exactly when and where we're going to be born. We didn't choose our parents. And so the idea of being thrown into the world in a certain time and place is itself very dramatic. But of course, this is going to compromise the notion of taking hold of yourself, because you take hold of yourself not in a vacuum, but you take hold of yourself within a very particular historical and cultural context. Moreover, Heidegger is going to say, and here is where I think one can make some of the linkage to his Nazi attachments, that when one takes hold of oneself, one doesn't break free of society. That would be the height of alienation, and that's very much what's wrong with contemporary technological and consumerist society. But rather, one takes a hold of oneself and appreciates one's traditions, one's history, or what Heidegger refers to as one's historicity, and one's essentially embeds oneself back as a matter of what he calls resoluteness in one's culture and one's time. And one can easily see, given what his culture and his time was, that he saw National Socialism and he saw German culture in general as not just herd mentality that he should escape, but quite to the contrary, a way in which he should take a hold of himself and reassert himself into it. There's a sense, too, in which to talk about the self in this way is to talk about the self in time, the second term of the title of Heidegger's famous book. To talk about time is not simply to talk, as philosophers often do, about what Heidegger refers to as clock time, the sort of time that's talked about by physicists, the sort of time we measure in making appointments. But to understand yourself is to understand the sense in which you are yourself in time and in many ways definitive of time. We talk about living in the moment, living in the present. The truth is, we never do. The present, in fact, is nothing but a razor-thin line between the past and the future. And when we think about ourselves, what we're always doing is thinking of ourselves in terms of our past and our history and our traditions, and at the same time, in terms of our future and our future projects in particular. To understand this is to understand that what we are as Dasein is, first of all, as creatures in time, but second, and more importantly, that to understand authenticity is going to be to understand how this attitude towards time enters into what it is to find and take hold of oneself.